The Dream Team tapes Season 2, Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team, is a production of Divergent Podcasts in association with iHeartRadio.
Welcome to Episode 2 of The Dream Team Tapes Season 2, Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. We're calling this Kobe's First Quarter. And as you listen to the details and descriptions of the ups and downs of Kobe Bryant's first 8 seasons in the NBA, keep in mind that all of this transpires through the time he was age 25. 25 years old. A quarter of a century. That's it. I'm J.A. Adande, and I got an up-close look at the Kobe Show while covering the Lakers for 10 years at the L.A. Times and 10 years at ESPN. And I'm joined by Jack McCallum, who made plenty of trips to L.A. when he chronicled the NBA for Sports Illustrated. And Jack, I'm wondering, did you ever come to L.A. with one story in mind, only to have Kobe take it over?
I'll tell you what, most prominently, it was during the strange summer of 2003, which you're going to be concentrating on. If you recall, the same weekend that the news about Kobe's alleged sexual assault in Colorado broke was the same weekend that the Lakers were proclaiming they had the new super team of the century. They had acquired Karl Malone and Gary the Glove Payton to go with a, you know, already great lineup with Kobe and Shaq. And that week, I had arranged to fly out with Karl Malone. He had hired a private plane to take him to L.A., When I got to the small town where he was hiding out, Jim Hill, by the way, the great L.A. sportscaster, were there, and it looked like, hey, this is going to be a great story about a super team, and next thing you know, the Kobe Bryant news that happened in Colorado had broke. I never did get to use the stuff from the Karl Malone plane ride.
Yeah, that was probably the ultimate example while Kobe was alive of him just taking over and dominating the news. It would happen all the time, though. I went up to cover the NFC Championship in 2006 up in Seattle, and usually the NFL's Championship Sunday, right, the two conference championship games is the big story. Lo and behold, what happens? Kobe drops 81 points on the Toronto Raptors and sort of takes over that storyline as well. It would happen again and again where Kobe would just come and dominate the news. And Jack, even in the afterlife, he could dominate the news. Following the tragic helicopter crash in January, Kobe Bryant dominated the 2020 All-Star Game in Chicago. And he even took over what should have been a tribute to David Stern, right? He had passed away on January 1st, and All-Star Weekend was really his creation. Under his tenure as the commissioner of the NBA, it went from just one game to this weekend filled with events and parties and all that. And it became the Kobe Show, a Kobe celebration. All the players wore Kobe's 24 or his daughter Gianna's number 2 in their jerseys during the game. He actually provided the news in Adam Silver's news conference.
We are renaming our All-Star MVP trophy the Kobe Bryant MVP Award.
Along those lines, Kobe's really taken over this entire episode, and that wasn't the original plan as we outlined the arc of this series, but really the accelerant in that shift was our interview with Phil Jackson, who was Kobe's coach from 1999 to 2011, with a notable one-year break in the 2004-05 season. And Jack, when we talked to Phil, he just really took us through this incredible journey of his time together with Kobe.
He could be a little elusive, but when you got him, it was never predictable. You know, he never took you out on what you, hey, a lot of times you go and interview somebody and I'm collecting the quotes to support what my thesis is. And there's guys that are really good at doing that. You know what they're going to say, but they're still really great at saying it. But Phil always did something that set you off on another path. And, you know, I think it's pretty obvious that when Kobe died, as was the case with many people, but certainly Phil, as much as anybody, you know, really started deeply thinking about these times with Kobe. And some of the things he said to us were among the best. You know, I've been doing this for 50 years, and it was really some of the best stuff that I had ever heard a coach talking about a player.
Yeah, at the end of our time with him, we asked him to summarize his relationship with Kobe. And he made it sound like something from a work of literature. Here he is.
Well, I think it's almost like a prodigal son story. And there I go into father elimination. illustration that, you know, there's conflict and there's willfulness and there's selfishness and there's I can do this on my own type of thing. And then there's, you know, this second life or second opportunity that really brings back tenderness, yielding. You know, it took two of us to have that complicated relationship early on, you know, trying to both be willful or directed. And his was to establish himself and his identity, and me to establish what a team had to do to win and the direction that teams have to have this unselfish behavior. And bending that will, I think, was done, you know, sometimes in, you know, unusual ways. Like one time coming to the facility, and I had a place that I had parking spot that was designated mine, and there was Kobe's car in my parking spot, you know, things like that. Just to, you know that he was going to irritate me, and me not reacting to it at all, you know, just going on about the day, you know, not taking umbrage at anything. And so we forged something that was harmonious, and that was one of the joys of our life. And, you know, my former pal and partner, Jeannie Buss, says that, you know, we raised him as a son of our own. So I guess there's something in that together.
So you can see why we had to clear the way for this. Much like Kobe, isolating on the wing so he could go one-on-one. Although I'd say Kobe's ability to steal the spotlight also is part of the Lakers and the way they steal the spotlight. There's something about that franchise. And a great example, as we get back to the context of USA Basketball, came in the 1996 Olympics. And USA Basketball executive Sean Ford told us that when they first got to Georgia ahead of the Olympic Games, and they get to their hotel, it's around midnight, and they credentialed everyone on the team and in the traveling party. And then he's told at 2 a.m. that he has to drive Shaquille O'Neal to the Westin Hotel. And he didn't ask why. And then they drive through Atlanta and they get to the Westin. And as they're pulling up, he discovered the reason.
They get out and Jerry West is waiting for him at the Lakers. And that's when he signed his contract with the Lakers.
So, Jack, if you remember that free agent signing when Shaq left the Orlando Magic, it overshadowed the start of the Olympics.
Absolutely. I mean, it did, as you said, overshadow the games. But that's kind of understandable. Shaq was at the height of his powers back then. And Jerry West's signing of him, you know, I talked to Jerry how many years after that is now, you know, 25 years later, with however many signings Jerry has done, including, you know, drafting Kobe, he still gets excited when he talks about that Shaq signing. It's really an interesting phenomenon.
Well, remember at the time, he compared it to the birth of his children, and it was that monumental an event for him. And what we didn't realize, though, was that he was equally as excited about his draft day trade for Kobe Bryant. And initially, I don't think we gave that enough attention. There was curiosity about Kobe. You know, high school players going straight to the NBA was still a novelty. The year before, in 95, Kevin Garnett had become the first player to skip straight to the pros in 20 years. And with Kobe, it was the first time that a guard had done it. So there was that new aspect of it. And I went up to the Lakers' first road game of the season. I was working in Washington, D.C. at the time. I took the train up to Penn Station in New York City and went upstairs to Madison Square Garden. And there was so much demand for young Kobe in one of his first games as a pro that they actually did a separate press conference for him before their game against the Knicks.
You know, back then, obviously people knew about Kobe. Clips were not passed back virally back and forth. I don't remember. Maybe you do. But I don't remember 1,000 Kobe clips at, you know, Lower Merion High School being passed back and forth. Now, in the next episode, we're going to be talking about LeBron. By that time, it was different. You know, 8 years later, everybody who was a basketball fan had seen LeBron. And Kobe really didn't play in any of these, as I recall, any of these super games, you know, get matched like LeBron against Carmelo and stuff like that. So Kobe, as you said, was still a little bit of a secret. I mean, not a full secret, but a little bit.
Yeah, and we talked to Eric Aldridge, who was the Lakers' assistant PR director at the time. He was actually the guy that picked up Kobe at the airport to drive him to his now legendary pre-draft workout with the Lakers at the Inglewood YMCA. And he spoke on that aspect, Jack.
A big part of the mystique of Kobe was we didn't really know who he was. I mean, again, this was pre-social media. It was a lot of word of mouth.
But once the Laker fans got to see Kobe for themselves, starting in a summer league game and then early with his time with the Lakers, they really formed a quick bond, as Aldridge noticed.
Well, I think from my perspective, what I saw was, you know, people love, you know, watching brilliance. If you think about, you know, Tiger Woods, you think about athletes who were so good, so young, and then you're watching it unfold in front of your eyes. I mean, it's almost like watching your own kid. You know, you see it, you see the potential, but he's not there yet. It was clear that he wasn't there yet, but you could see it. But not only could you see it, you could see him working towards it. And I think that's the thing that connected him with the fan base.
And then Robert Horry was traded to the Lakers during Kobe's rookie season. And from his first practice with the team, he noticed that Kobe was working towards it, even when the fans and the TV cameras weren't around.
I remember Kobe was just like, everybody's going like at a third of a speed and Kobe's going 100 and shoot around. Like, does this guy know this is a shoot around? And he was like, you know, I got to go hard because I'm trying to start. I'm like, dude, it's shoot around. Nobody goes hard. And he just had all this energy. And I said, that's an 18-year-old for you, you know. You're going to have all that energy. And when you wait till this 82 game grind hits you, you're going to slow down. And it was just one of those things. He was just trying to learn the game. And he was just one of those guys that was in the gym constantly trying to get better. I mean, every play, he was going hard.
So Kobe had his formula for greatness on the court, but he didn't have a pathway to bonding with his teammates. And part of it was the age gap. Kobe was born in 1978. The next youngest player on the team was born in 1974. And put it this way, how much time did you spend hanging out with seniors during your freshman year in college? And of course, Kobe never had any of that college experience. You know, that transition time when you're away from home, everybody's on equal footing, you're in the dorms, you're sharing sleeping quarters with a roommate. You've all got this community bathroom down the hall. And as Aldridge put it,
he just didn't have those social skills built up yet.
So Aldridge also remembers a time early in Kobe's career when he and some of the players went to a TGI Fridays after a preseason game in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And Kobe walks in the restaurant. He didn't even join them at first. That was a rookie faux pas. And when he finally came over, he's astounded that the players are drinking. Like, he couldn't believe they had a game to play the next night and they're drinking alcohol. And Robert Horry was one of the players at the table, and he recalled that night.
It was all about bonding. And I think he didn't understand that. It's about coming together and bonding, because if you think about it, I always believed that it was a disconnect, because here's this 18-year-old. What do you have in common with an 18-year-old and a 22-year-old? You might just probably video games at the time. Video games were at the level they are now. So it was a disconnect there. And I think when he turned 21, he was like, okay, I'm a part of the crew now. But the disconnect was, the wall, I should say, was up so hard, it was kind of to reconnect.
We'll be back with more Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team after this. So then in 1999, there's a huge new personality added to the mix, Phil Jackson. There had been a series of playoff disappointments with the Lakers, so that led to the firing of Coach Del Harris, and then the Lakers didn't think his replacement, Kurt Rambis, was up to the task. And Phil Jackson was available, the reason why it was covered pretty extensively in The Last Dance. And the Lakers signed Phil to a 5-year, $30 million contract. And Jack, that was really big bucks for a coach at the time.
It was sort of a little version of what had happened in Chicago. Jordan was very, very close to Doug Collins. He had gotten them to a certain point. And, you know, you don't know whether Phil is back there studying the situation and going, okay, I think it's time, you know. And it's obviously a combination of taking over a team when they're ready to mature. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But it's also Phil's got a little bit of a magic touch that he was able to add. And next thing you know, three titles in a row.
Yeah, and Phil, when he took over Chicago, A, he was coming from inside. He wasn't coming from the outside. But the advantage he had when he came to the Lakers was that he was minted with six championships. And so they had to respect him. He commanded their respect. And I think in part it was a message to the star players that they had to get serious or they could be the ones out the next time. And they responded. As Robert Horry noted from the first day of training camp, when they get there and he sees that Kobe's bulked up and Shaq has slimmed down.
It's almost like they were scared of Phil. They got in the best shape of their lives. They were looking good. And they were like, oh, we got to be ready for this upcoming season.
And so Kobe was so eager to learn from Phil Jackson, his idol, Michael Jordan's coach, that he went to meet with Phil before his introductory press conference at the Beverly Hilton Hotel. Meanwhile, Shaq crossed paths with Phil that summer at Jackson's getaway cabin in Montana.
He was riding around the bay on some jet skis that he had borrowed from neighbors. As far as you could see, people were standing out on their docks and looking at him. And he'd been jumping on the trampoline that was in my yard. And my neighbors kept seeing this figure show up above the boathouse. And Shaq was jumping on the trampoline. And then he went off to the dock and he dove in the dock and then he borrowed some jet skis and went around. So the big fun-loving guy, you know, was somebody I knew already.
And in that story, you can hear the affection for Shaq in Phil's voice. And he was also intrigued by the chance to coach a dominant center. And that was the one element he didn't have with the Chicago teams. And so Jackson made Shaq the focal point of the offense, but Kobe didn't always follow the plan.
He would just go rogue. And I'd pull him to the sideline and say, it's not the time to try and take over the game yet. I'll get back to it. He'd go back and run the offense for a little bit. But, you know, everything was predicated to going through Shaq a lot at that time because that's what I said, well, that's what we're going to do. That's how we're going to attack this team and this game. And, Kobe got tired of doing that.
But Kobe was capable of playing and of working alongside Shaq. And there's three championship banners in Staples Center to prove it. When Kobe and Shaq joined forces at the top, their combined powers were unbeatable. And what's interesting to me is that Phil Jackson singled out the same moment that I always reference as the display of Kobe and Shaq at their collaborative best. And it's the play near the end of Game 7 of the 2000 Western Conference Finals. It's when Kobe crossed up Scottie Pippen, then he threw a lob to Shaq. And that's the one that finished off their comeback against the Portland Trail Blazers, and it sent them on to the NBA Finals.
I think it was solidified when Shaq understood that Kobe knew how to win, what was necessary to win, and was able to do the things that created the wins, and that he would give up the ball at the right time to create this. One of the demonstrating moments was that dunk against Portland in the game, the seventh game of that series, when, you know, all of a sudden, you know, there was a move in which everybody was expecting Kobe to make some kind of a shot or whatever, and he just put the ball up there for Shaq to ram it down through the hoop. And I think that was really a moment that kind of solidified everything, and they kind of understood then that they were going to do whatever it took to win.
It felt like the Lakers would keep winning championships for the foreseeable future. Shaq was 28. Kobe was 21. This was his version of college graduation. And that was an element that the Lakers, who had pretty much stayed set for throughout their three championships, and they just weren't ready for that element. And losing that, of course, led to that drastic change that you mentioned earlier when they brought in Gary Payton and Karl Malone, and they said, okay, we need to upgrade, and they majorly upgraded. But meanwhile, the mileage of all those deep playoff runs had really worn down Kobe's knee, and unbeknownst to the Lakers, he went to Eagle, Colorado to get surgery.
He just did it out of the blue. The club was totally surprised at the incident and everything. And all hell broke loose after that.
And while he was in Colorado, Kobe had a sexual encounter with a hotel employee, and she later accused him of sexual assault. And all that led to the most surreal press conference I've ever attended. And it featured Kobe, his wife Vanessa, and his attorney Pamela Mackey, whose voice you'll hear first from in the clip from that day.
Kobe Bryant is innocent of the charges that were filed against him today.
I'm innocent. I didn't force her to do anything against her will. I'm innocent.
And that case just loomed over the whole season, even despite the additions of those two future Hall of Fame players. And it also increased the tension between Shaq and Kobe. You know, Shaq had learned that Kobe brought Shaq's name into the statement that he gave police. And one thing it did was create even more distance between Phil and Kobe. And at a time that Kobe probably could have used more support and advice, Phil's approach was to give Kobe more space. And Phil just didn't know what to make of Kobe's presence on the team.
You just felt the anger emanating out of his being. I don't know, he's angry at himself. He's angry at the situation. He's angry at the public exposure. There are a lot of things. I never felt really comfortable with it. And I just decided to be hands off in that situation. It felt like a personal affront to me.
Keep in mind all the other things at play. Phil Jackson was in the last year of his contract. He was trying to get an extension. Shaq had another year left on his contract, but he wanted an extension. And Kobe, this was the key, could become a free agent after the season. And for the first time, he was in a position to flex his leverage. And I don't know if Kobe ever gave Lakers owner Jerry Buss an ultimatum that he would leave unless Buss got rid of Shaq and Phil. What I do know, I can't explain how, but trust me, I do know that Buss really didn't think Jackson should keep coaching that team. And he also realized that he couldn't keep both Shaq and Kobe, that one of them was going to have to go. They couldn't coexist any longer. That was his mindset. I don't know the extent that Kobe influenced, but I'm really confident that that was Jerry Buss's mentality at the time.
I'm interested. You were out there, and I always have this theory. And when you say something's a theory, that means it doesn't have to be correct. But I always thought that it had to be like somebody's team, not two guys' team. You know, it had to be one guy's team. And
yeah.
It always was fascinating to me because Shaq was such a dominant figure. And maybe it's just because I knew him better. I had worked on a book with him in his rookie year. And I kind of knew I could always gravitate to him. He, as you said, he was a dominant player. They were still using, feed the post type of situation. And the triangle utilized the post person. So Shaq was dominant on the court. But, and you alluded to this, I think, there seemed to be in L.A. the affection between Kobe and the fans seemed to go beyond what the affection was for Shaq and the fans, which is interesting to me because it's a showman's town. And now Kobe was a showman too, but my God, Shaq.
Yeah.
So how do you kind of explain, A, whose team it was, and B, the incredible affection Kobe had with those Hollywood fans?
Part of it goes back to the old Will Chamberlain line, right, Jack? Nobody roots for Goliath. And even though Shaq was as warm and engaging a big man as we'd ever seen, and the Lakers had a tradition and a rich legacy of big men, going back to George Mikan and Wilt and Kareem, but those guys were never the favorites, right? Jerry West and Elgin Baylor were fan favorites over Wilt. Magic was the fan favorite over Kareem. The Laker fans never really bonded with Kareem the way they did with Magic. And I think just, again, as part of it, there's something more relatable. Why is Steph Curry so popular, right? Because he's closer in size to the average fan. And Kobe, even though he's tall, wasn't a behemoth like Shaq. And that was part of it. And you wonder if part of it also is that the only uniform that Kobe ever wore was a Lakers jersey. Maybe he wore that Charlotte Hornets cap on draft night, but from the time he played his first game, he was in a Laker uniform, whereas Shaq came from the Magic, and then of course later played on several teams after he left the Lakers. So there are all those factors.
And I'm guessing after the sexual assault charge, Kobe became a more complicated figure, a figure of redemption. So he became a character that people understand in Hollywood. When they're pitching a movie, people understand that. But Shaq never really had something like that.
Yeah, if anything, that experience, that ordeal of the sexual assault case bonded Kobe with the fans even more. And they zealously defended him from the get-go. And, he never lost the crowd. It never cost him his standing with the Laker fans.
You're listening to Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. We'll be back in just a moment. I remember that press conference, by the way, Jay, because as I said before, I was supposed to be writing the wonderful feel-good Gary Payton, Karl Malone join up for the super team. And there was this guy next to me. And he goes, where are you from? I said, I'm from Sports Illustrated. He was not impressed. He went, I'm from Celebrity Justice. Apparently there was a thing, I don't know, maybe it still exists, called Celebrity Justice. And I went, oh, shit, man, we're in a different world here.
It was. And that season, it was Access Hollywood and E! And it just became this whole other thing. And that press conference, it felt like a movie just because I never thought I would be there for something like that for Kobe Bryant. It wasn't outlandish that an athlete could find himself in this circumstance, but Kobe Bryant, it seemed unfathomable that he would stand before us accused of sexual assault.
And you have the problem of how to, I don't want to use the word spin because that's not what you're doing, but when you write a story or when you're broadcasting, you were writing back. Were you still writing back then? Yeah.
I covered almost every game of that season for the LA Times.
So you have to figure out, you know, which way you're kind of shading it. Do you express utter disbelief? The one thing you cannot do is, you know, begin casting, as some people do, you know, begin casting aspersions on the accuser, you know, right away. And it's a very, you know, it's a very difficult story to write. And to this day, it is a very difficult thing to deal with in kind of a no-win situation. I mean, there's a woman who worked at Sports Illustrated who I deeply respected, who, you know, got really angry one day because she thought, as the years went on, now this is years later, you know, maybe it was when Kobe scored 81 or Kobe won two in a row. Why are you still glorifying this guy? Why are you still? And, you know, my point was, I can't begin every story with Kobe Bryant, who was accused of an assault in Colorado in July of 2003. You can't begin every story like that a person deserves a chance to go on and grow. But it's a tough, you know, journalistic lesson, I think, for anybody to handle. Do you agree?
Yeah, and it's made even more difficult in that we never got the definitive declaration of guilt or innocence from a court resolution, right? It was dropped before it went to court. Again, he reached agreement. And that's why I maintain we have to allow for the possibility that the accuser saw this resolved to her satisfaction. You know, there was a large settlement made, and Kobe agreed to apologize. And he issued an apology and an explanation. And the accuser said she would no longer cooperate with the prosecutors. And that basically ended the case. And it's possible that that was enough to satisfy, and she felt, you know, justice had been served in that regard and that she got what she wanted. We don't know. We've never heard from her. So maybe she's still upset. Maybe she feels like it was insufficient. But the fact that we never did hear from her, and I'm certain, you know, there was a degree of silence that was part of the agreement that was reached, but we've never heard otherwise. So that's one thing I take into consideration. And again, a lot of this came up again after Kobe died, is that how much of his story should we allocate for this? And should it dominate? As you said, should it be in the lead paragraph, but in his obituary? I'm not certain. And especially, you do have to allow for growth. And then we'll hear from Phil Jackson over the course of the series, the growth that he made in his relationship, the steps that Kobe took in order for them to have a productive working relationship toward the latter part of Phil's career and the second half of Kobe's career. And we look at Kobe, what he went on to do and become such an advocate for women's sports, which is what he almost became known for, and in particular his daughter. And at the time of his passing, he had really become a champion for the WNBA. So all of those things came into play by the end.
Yeah, it's unusual. You know, a lot of sports figures or celebrities have their great falling at the end.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Woody Hayes went for years when his behavior was like sort of right on the edge. But Kobe was different. You know, as you said, I'm not excusing his age, by the way. He was certainly old enough, you know, not to know that extramarital sex was wrong, whatever happened. But all this happened so early in his career, and he had so much of his life to live. And as much as he had time to be derided by fans for it, he also had the time to change.
Exactly.
As a human being.
But Jack, getting back to that notion that his age, and as we've titled this episode, it was the first quarter. And in a way that benefited him because it allowed for him to make the comeback. So he still had the prime of his career to come. And one thing that we've learned in sports is that if you win, if you get back to the top, much is forgiven. And so one of the reasons that the Kobe Bryant story is told in the manner it is that he went on to win two more championships after this low point, and certainly 2003-04 is the absolute low point, but he pulled himself back from that. But at the time, it was so different, and it's hard to believe that Phil Jackson that you heard at the top of this episode and the affection that he had for Kobe Bryant, that certainly wasn't the case in 03-04. And Phil actually, at that point, wanted complete separation from Kobe. He even went to the front office and asked to get Kobe traded. And we know this because he wrote about it in his Diary of the Season that came out that summer, and also because he told it to us once again when we spoke to him for this podcast.
I just went in and talked to the management and said, you know, I don't think this is the right time right now. I think Kobe's uncoachable at this particular time in his life. And I don't know what your direction is, but I think you have to really assess whether you want to sign Kobe for more or how you want to deal with this situation.
And so that happened, we believe the timeline is in January 2004. And then there's various reports about what happened. There's supposedly a meeting that Kobe had with Jerry Buss on Super Bowl Sunday. What I do know is that it all spilled out in the open the week right up before the All-Star game. The last game before the All-Star break, the Lakers are in Houston, and they announce that they're pulling their contract extension offer for Phil Jackson off the table. So he's basically going to be a lame duck in the second half of the season. And Shaq was very upset by that. We asked Kobe his reaction. He said, I don't care. That three-word quote, I don't care. So that showed where their relationship was. And then it's the All-Star break. And we talk about the Lakers overshadowing things. Well, they overshadowed that All-Star break. It's in Los Angeles. And I remember people at the NBA were so mad because that's supposed to be their showcase, their time to hype and promote the league. And all anyone is talking about is the squabbling between the Lakers and their superstars.
Shaq did call me after the All-Star game and said Kobe basically said something that was derogative towards you at the All-Star game. And I think you should talk to him. And I said, you know, Kobe just is going through a difficult time right now. It's hard for him to take directions. He's angry. He feels isolated and he's drawn into himself. And I think the best thing to do is just let him be. I think that he'll find his way through this. And so I didn't make an issue out of that. But I do know that that the contentious nature was part of his carriage at that time. And he was announced to be a free agent, I believe, right before the draft that year. And I was dealing with an extension on my contract at the same time.
Jack, the irony is that basically, Kobe set Shaq up to be the MVP of that All-Star game. After all they've been going through, Kobe kept passing him the ball, and Shaq wins the MVP of that All-Star game.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this, I don't think people understand the day-to-day totality of how a team is together, like how much they're together, how they can get on each other's nerves. And one of the great things I think about Jerry Buss, you have Phil, a great coach, a great, you know, one day, well, we got to get rid of Kobe. Next thing you know, he's winning championships with him. And one of the great things about an owner like Jerry Buss, who's not involved in this day-to-day rigmarole, is he sits back and goes and has a very clear vision. I think Kobe Bryant is the best guy to win us more titles. It was like what he said with Magic. I don't care if we trade the whole damn team. I want Magic Johnson, you know? And that's one of the things a clear-headed owner will do. And that's why, hey, I'm sure Jerry Buss did some, you know, made some stupid decisions like every other owner. But I tell you what, the guy had his eye on the prize. And the prize out of the aughts was going to be Kobe Bryant. And he saw it. And, you know, I'm not sure, Jay, what I would have said about it if I had that decision. But he had his decision, that's for sure.
And so the way the rest of that season played out is that they lose in the NBA Finals. It had pretty much been determined, I'm sure, that Jerry Buss decided that Kobe was going to be the guy going forward and he was going to be the centerpiece of this team. And within a few weeks of the end of those NBA Finals, Phil Jackson is out as coach, and then Shaquille O'Neal is traded to Miami, and the Lakers, as we had known them, are no more. And everything wasn't finished for Kobe, though, because he still had to resolve the sexual assault case he was facing in Colorado. And ultimately, they reached the resolution of that we discussed earlier, and they settle out of court, and the accuser drops the case and will no longer cooperate with the prosecutor. The problem for Kobe, though, was he had no idea that it was going to play out that way. And so because of that, he couldn't promise USA Basketball, he couldn't make that commitment to play with them for the Olympic team in Athens that year. And you wonder if that changes the whole course of history, right? Going back to the initial allegation in the summer of 2003, it's still having an impact here in the summer of 2004, and it keeps Kobe off the Olympic team because he just couldn't make that commitment. He didn't know what his schedule, what his life was going to be like. He didn't even know if he'd be a free man at the point of the Olympics. And so you wonder, though, if he had been on that team, do they lose? Do they finish with the bronze medal? Or does Kobe get them to the gold medal as he ends up doing in 2008? And if they do win the gold medal, do we not have that reboot of the USA Basketball program led by Jerry Colangelo? And do we not even have the whole Redeem team and USA Basketball as we know it now? It's a pretty significant what if.
2020 hindsight, but I covered those games, the 2004 Olympic Games in Athens. And I can tell you this, Jay, I doubt in game one when Carlos Arroyo made the United States look like a JV team, I don't think Kobe would have stood for that shit. So
I'm gonna
bet that it would have been different. But I tell you what, our episode 3 coming up is about the other alpha dog on his 2008 Redeem team, LeBron James. We're going to be hearing about his tale and 3 other players from the Redeem team who were in that great 2003 draft class, Carmelo Anthony, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh. And also an account of those strange 2004 Olympics when we only came home with a bronze medal.
There's no pressure. There's no pressure at all. I've been getting pressure since I was 10 years old.
I think things could have been different, but we never had time. I mean, we came at the last minute. Me and LeBron and Dewey, we got the calls at the last minute. And the way that we looked at it was like, shit, we on here for the roster filling.
I'm Jack McCallum.
And I'm Jay Adande.
Thanks for listening to Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team. The Dream Team Tapes Season 2, Kobe, LeBron, and the Redeem Team, is a production of Diversion Podcasts in association with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This season is written and hosted by me, Jack McCallum, and J.A. Adande. Executive producers Scott Waxman and Mark Francis for Diversion Podcasts, and Sean Titone for iHeartRadio. Our editorial director is John Tuttle. Supervising producer, Brian Murphy. Legal producer, Freddie Overstegen. Editing, mixing, and sound design by Mark Francis. Verna Fields is our technical producer, and our director of marketing and business development is Jacob Bronstein.
Diversion Podcasts.